Welcome to Module 1, Video 9, General Protocols for Working with the Mind. This is Dr. Miles Nichols. Harvard research on meditation has shown that meditation is incredibly important for doing some phenomenal things that seem almost in the realm of science fiction. One is increased gray matter density in the hippocampus. The hippocampus, of course, is the region of the brain that regulates memory. And memory, of course, is something that tends to decline very quickly with neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and dementia. So increased gray matter density in the hippocampus is an amazing finding, a physiological change in the brain that's happening through meditation practice, and a decrease in the gray matter density in the amygdala that regulates the fear response. Less anxiety and less depression have been findings for meditation, not only that, but actual physiologic changes in the density of the amygdala of the brain. Now, if someone were to ask you if you were to be able to actually stimulate new growth of gray matter in an area of the brain that would prevent neurodegenerative disease and improve memory, and to decrease gray matter in an area of the brain that causes fear and anxiety and negative thought patterns, would you then feel like that's an important thing to do if there's something that is simple, is free of charge, and can help those things to happen? Absolutely. Meditation is, there's been research that's shown that, of course, we know stress is a big thing, and people need vacation, people need to relax, people need to get away from the day-to-day. And one way to do that is to take vacation, but there was a trial comparing vacation to a meditation retreat, and meditation retreat was shown to have, both were shown to have impactful benefits on lowering cortisol levels, but the meditation retreat was shown to have those impacts last longer after coming back from that retreat. Now, have you ever been on vacation where you go and you feel relaxed and like you've let go? Your cortisol levels have probably gone down, but then you come back, you get back into the day-to-day, and within just a few days, you feel stressed out again and like it was almost as if you didn't go. So meditation retreats don't have that. They have this capacity to almost have created a new threshold or level for resilience in the face of stress. I think about it as having increased tolerance for stress so that stress can be more than it was previously, where you would have gotten out of sorts and off center, but now you're staying centered and calm. That's how meditation retreats, I personally experience and are shown in some research to have evidence of that. We see increased telomere length, which telomeres, of course, are associated with longevity. And so living a longer time, a longer life, that's a very important thing. Many, I believe, people today want to improve quality of life and duration of life. And we see both quality of life through a decrease in fear and anxiety, through a greater tolerance for stress. And we also see prolonged life, longevity. And meditation, of course, is a much more pleasant strategy than some of the other longevity strategies like ongoing caloric restriction, which usually comes with fatigue and weakness and muscle degeneration, and not so much of a pleasant experience overall to do long-term calorie restriction all the time. Now, short-term cycles of calorie restriction, maybe that's fine, but meditation can be done ongoingly, day-to-day, and promote longevity. Additional research on meditation is abundant and robust. There's lots of research on meditation. Some of the research shows a balance between sympathetic and parasympathetic responses. So that fight-flight response and then that rest-digest response, balancing those out. We want some sympathetic response when it's appropriate. Most people, though, are a little too sympathetic dominant and not enough of a robust response in the parasympathetic. So vagal nerve activation, the branches of the vagal nerve that are related to parasympathetic activity are important and are triggered, are activated through meditation practice. Improved focus and concentration. One of the big obstacles or objections that people give for not meditating every single day is it takes time and we're busy, right? Busy schedules, busy lives. But when we know through research that it's very clear that meditation improves focus and concentration, we can clearly see that it improves productivity if we're more focused and concentrated, meaning we're going to get more done in less time, meaning we're going to save time in the long run. Improved self-awareness. The more aware a person is of themselves, the better they're able to choose conscious responses to situations. The kinds of unconscious reactivities that people have when they regret things later, like, gosh, that person was yelling at me and I got frustrated and I threw something, or I broke something, or I yelled, or I didn't want to yell. And so that kind of unconscious response, I didn't want to do it, but I was compelled in the moment through these intense sensations in my body. I just reacted. I didn't even think. Well, improved self-awareness through meditation means less of that. More awareness of the internal impulse to have that reactivity that I would regret later. I'm not going to do it though because I have that self-awareness about it. Self-awareness is incredibly important. It's part of how we change. It's part of how we grow and evolve. If you want to develop as a person, meditation is one of the best ways to do that. Reduced negative effects from stress. We talked a little bit about this before, but it's almost as if you have a higher stress resilience and tolerance and threshold to allow stress to be a part of your life without having negative consequences from it. And let's face it, some stress is unavoidable. There are avoidable stresses, and we want to minimize those, but the ones that are unavoidable, we might as well allow for ourselves to become more resilient. Meditation is a way to do that. Improved immune health. We see better outcomes with less sick days from people who are doing meditation. Imagine the also benefit of saving time from not being sick and being able to continue to either work or do what you love for more days of the year. Immune health, of course, is incredibly important and is related to overall health and wellness and longevity as well. Improved insulin sensitivity and reduced lipid peroxidation. So insulin sensitivity, of course, is very, very important, and many, many people are becoming insulin resistant and then later pre-diabetic and then later diabetic. And even if blood glucose is normal and it's not pre-diabetic, still some people are starting to become insulin resistant, and that is a process that's setting people up for problems later. So improving insulin sensitivity is preventing diabetes and metabolic disorders. Reducing lipid peroxidation is reducing cardiovascular disease risk, because part of atherosclerosis involves the oxidative processes of cholesterol, and when we can reduce that, we're reducing cardiovascular disease risk, which of course is the number one killer. And reduced cardiovascular disease risk in general has been shown for meditation, reducing the disease risk factors for heart attack, for stroke. There's a bunch of additional research for specific conditions. We have chronic lower back pain, or really any chronic pain, being reduced through meditation. Fibromyalgia, rheumatoid arthritis, psoriasis, type 2 diabetes, and insomnia, meaning people are sleeping better. We see that for us, I mean, it's just clear, of course, we should be meditating. Everyone should be meditating unless there are good reasons not to, which would be schizophrenic or certain mental disorders that are very, very severe, may not be a good fit for meditation practice. But almost everyone, general health, should be meditating. A moving and a non-moving practice daily is our general recommendation. And moment to moment on the fly practice, so day to day issues, things happening, when things happen, when emotions get elevated, when there's a stressful situation, a day-to-day self-awareness, mindfulness type of practice in the moment, on the fly, is also incredibly important. So step one to being able to do a successful meditation practice is set a scheduled time. Make it the same time, have consistency. Just like brushing your teeth first thing in the morning and right before bed, setting a scheduled time for meditation is very, very important. People sometimes ask, what's the best time for meditation? Well, actually, the best time for meditation is the time when you're going to be the most consistently available, where you're going to have the least distractions around. So for some people, that's going to be first thing in the morning. For some people, last thing before bed. For some people, smack dab in the middle of the day when other family and people aren't around. So you have to figure out that time for yourself. Step two is to also include, when we're working with the mind, in addition to set scheduled time for meditation, we also want to include some spontaneous play activity, some activity that is non-focused and a little more for fun. Fun, of course, is an important part of how we regulate our stress, and so it's important that we do that as well. And so Dr. Stuart Brown's done some research on play and talked about properties of play. So one thing is that it's purposeless. It's done for its own sake, not for another reason. It's voluntary. You're not being coerced or forced into it. It has this inherent attraction. If other people see you playing, see someone playing, they want to join in or watch or feel some draw to it. It involves freedom from time. There's this feeling of timelessness, not wanting to really go do something else. There's this feeling of getting lost in the moment. And a diminished sense of self, like, it's not about me. This is about a dynamic and a dance and a relational practice that's unfolding. And then it improves improvisational potential. There's this spontaneity, this sense of arising something new, not knowing what's going to happen next. And there's a production of a continuous desire, really continuously being engaged and enjoying the process and wanting to continue on with the process. So step three is mental challenge. We want to challenge our mind. We want to, just like we work a muscle through working out, through lifting weights, through challenging that muscle with weight that's difficult for it to lift, we're going to want to challenge the mind as well with things like puzzles, things that are games that are requiring complex thought processes, abstract thought processes, and right brain creative challenges as well, like an instrument, learning a sport, playing a sport. These kinds of mental challenges can be really, really important for working with the mind. And then step four for working with the mind involves service, purpose activities, sharing with others, giving a gift to the world, finding in your heart what is something that you want to offer out. What are you passionate about? What is your mission? Finding that and sharing that with the world. Step five is lead by example. I think it's pretty easy for us as health practitioners to understand how important leading by example is. I know I personally wouldn't want to go to a doctor or a clinician who's overweight when I'm trying to lose weight as my main goal. And this, I believe, should be applied into the mind side as well as the physical side. As holistic health clinicians, functional medicine clinicians, clinicians interested in the next evolution of functional medicine and mindfulness medicine, we want not only to be physically leading by example through proper sleep and nutrition and managing our stress as well and being able to really shine, really have our own stuff figured out, really have worked through most of our own chronic disease processes or illnesses or issues that we're having or symptoms that we're having. And of course, it's so powerful to, as clinicians, tell your story of transformation about how you were fatigued, how you were having a struggle with a gut issue that was a long time or a chronic infection, and that you worked through that with functional medicine. I know that's a story that I share in my conversations with clients and that Dr. Diane shares in her conversations with potential clients, and that we feel like it's a very, very powerful tool to lead by example. And that should be the case with mindfulness too. For me, I personally meditate every day. And I meditate before I go to bed if I haven't meditated previously that day. And it doesn't matter if I'm not going to get enough sleep. It doesn't matter if it's already 2 a.m. It doesn't matter if I've been traveling and have to wake up early. I just do it. On those nights where it's a little bit of a struggle to get enough sleep, I might do it for a short time. It might only be a 5-minute meditation or a 10-minute meditation. On nights where I have plenty of time, it might be an hour-long meditation. And I might be a second meditation where I have meditated earlier in the day as well. But I know that I'm going to do it, and I know that I'm going to do it before I go to bed, no matter what. It's just my ritual, my practice, my before-bed activity. And so I encourage for you to find ways to, if you value meditation, if you value mindfulness, if you're convinced by the research, but you haven't yet gotten it to the level of practicing every single day, I recommend that you find a way. I think most of us brush our teeth every day, and we have that ritual of in the morning and at night. And to be able to also do a meditation practice at least once per day, consistently, ritualistically, to make it into a practice that's a regular and reliable thing. And for some, maybe once a week going to a class might be enough. That's better than nothing, certainly. And I do truly, honestly believe that daily practice is where the biggest benefits come from meditation and on-the-fly mindfulness day-to-day as well. So I do suggest that we lead by example as clinicians. I do this personally, and I recommend that you find a way in yourself to get motivated to, even if it's only 5 minutes, have a every single day kind of meditation type of practice, because it makes a big difference. It's researched to do all sorts of amazing things, as you know. And by leading by example, you're going to show to your clients that you can speak confidently about the mindfulness practices and meditation practices and the importance of them, and how really actually to manage stress. Don't just say manage your stress, but actually how do we really do that in an effective way that actually is significant towards improved health outcomes. So this is a very important topic. I hope you all take it to heart. And this is the end of this module. In the next module, it's module 2, we'll be talking about small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. Now, on the physiological root causes, the gut is huge, and it's our often first go-to place where we're going to look for dysfunction. And it's not just gut dysfunction. SIBO's related to, and there's a gut-skin connection, there's a gut-brain connection, there's a gut-hormone connection. Really, skin and hormones and brain health and gut health are all interlinked. There's a gut-immune connection. So we're really looking forward to sharing with you one of the main root causes for gut dysfunction called small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, and that is coming to you next. Thank you so much for watching.